and welcome to Beyond Markets by Julius Baer, a series featuring conversations with experts to share recent market developments, key insights, and strategic inputs from around the globe.
Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Julius Baer podcast. This is Rich Tang, the China strategist and head of research Hong Kong for Bank Julius Baer. It's time again for our monthly conversation with Grow, and let me welcome Hong Hao back to our podcast to discuss China, and Hao is currently the partner and chief economist of Grow. Hi Hao, thank you very much for your time speaking with us today.
Hi Richard.
Hao, let's start today's episode with the topic of currency, because a lot of RMB investors or those who hold on to RMB denominated assets have been focusing on this currency trend recently, especially since this year began. The Chinese yuan was strengthening against the dollar during November and December last year, when the US dollar CNY spot went from 7.3 to 7.1 in just 2 months of time. But getting into this year in 2024, the Chinese currency has weakened again, and the depreciation has become faster getting into the second half of March. So, how, what do you think are the reasons that drove the RMB from appreciation late last year to now depreciation? And on top of this, I'm sure the bigger question to a lot of investors is whether the US dollar CNY spot will go above the 7.3 to 7.4 level, which was the last year's high. What's your view?
Well, I think the RMB is going to stay on the weak side for the time being, because according to economic theory, the impossible trinity. So basically, a country can capital flow, interest rate, and exchange rate. So three factors, a country can only control two of them. So now that China wants to maintain rigid or rigorous cross-border capital control, China wants to sort of have its own say on domestic interest rate, and therefore it's leaving the exchange rate wide open. And I think that is the reason why the fixing every day is way, way stronger than the CNH, the offshore Chinese exchange rate, is showing. So it's consistently showing the widest gap between the fixing and the market rate. So that is telling us two things. One, the central bank is very determined to maintain a relatively strong Chinese currency relative to the market expectation. And secondly, I think, you know, the market obviously is having a different view. The market is thinking that the currency should go lower, et cetera, et cetera. So as a result, you know, 2 weeks ago, we saw the PBOC is trying to test water by weakening the fixing by a few cents. And immediately, the market threw up a fist. Basically, the Hong Kong market was down like 3% on the day. And I think the onshore market is down more than 1% on the day. That is showing that the Chinese currency is now one of the most important factor swaying the market prices. I think going forward, you know, because obviously, we are not going to relinquish cross-border capital control, and when we are going to maintain a steady but lower interest rate, so the pressure on the Chinese yuan will linger on. So I wouldn't be surprised to see the Chinese yuan revisit the prior 7.3 or even more, or even higher than 7.3 in the weeks to come. But having said that, though, that may not be such a bad news. So just now I mentioned, right, so because China wants to maintain its control on capital flow and also on domestic interest rate. To me, the currency rate is a given, given this setting. So the currency rate, even though the market consensus see it as the most important swing factors on determining market prices, but it shouldn't be, you know, because you have already got the two other factors set. So the currency exchange rate is now a given. So it shouldn't be more uncertainties regarding which direction it's going to travel to. So to me, it's sort of puzzling, but I think over time this year, because the Chinese and US are reopening, re-establishing dialogues on many channels, for example, the military generals are talking again once more, Yellen is visiting China, second time in less than a year. So all these are telltale signs that the bilateral relationship is improving. It's not at least, you know, there should be less animosity, you know, between the two countries. And this year is a very important year in the U.S. election cycle. So I think a marginally improved Sino-U.S. relationship may not be in the price yet.
Interesting points. Well, I guess the stock market is probably drawing even more attention from investors than the forex market. And I feel that the Asia and Hong Kong stock markets are finally bringing back hope to us, given that the Shanghai Comp has gone from the February low of 2600 to almost 3100, while the Hang Seng Index has recovered to around 17,000 since it broke below 15,000 in late January. Now, the Chinese stock market was largely consolidating its gain in March, but towards the end of the month, the market has all of a sudden become hopeful that the China QE may be coming after President Xi's comments at the PBOC. Well, most economists so far think that the chance of a QE in China is still very low, and the market may have overreacted. Now, how about you, Hao? Do you think the market has overreacted? But let's say if this is still true, that China is indeed launching QE similar to what the West did, what should be the theoretical impact to the financial market as well as the real economy?
Yeah, I've seen quite a bit of a speculation going on in the investment circle as well. I think firstly, we have been discussing the direction of the Chinese market in the last episodes. We actually said that the market low reached just before the Chinese New Year was actually an important low for the year. And let's hope that low will hold for the rest of the year. Then it would later on, we find some proof that it's actually a great buying opportunity for many people who are investing in this part of the world. I think ever since then, the Chinese market has come back in a very substantial way. So the Hang Seng Tech Index actually entered a technical bull market recently after rising 20%. All these are happening without the QE. Right, so what that means is that the market actually repair itself without much help on the QE front. So what that means is that right now, if you want to really launch a QE, you really want to figure out what kind of the market you're trying to rescue or to what purpose are you trying to achieve? Because the Asia Shanghai Composite is steady at around 3,000 level and trying to consolidate. I think the Hong Kong Hang Seng Index is around 17,000. It's an important technical level because that is where the 200-day moving average is. And so people are probably waiting to see whether the Hang Seng Index can break above, decisively above this 200-day moving average, and also whether the Shanghai Composite can move a step higher from 3,000. So all this are happening without the QE. So what that is really telling me that, you know, things are not so dire. If it's not so dire, you know, what is the foundation of launching a QE now instead of, say, last year when arguably the Chinese market needs more help then? So it's puzzling. I think the sort of a speculation of a Chinese QE actually come from some press reports about the PBO's OC changing its way of managing domestic liquidity by probably adding one more instrument into its toolbox. So the PBOC basically said that going to buy Chinese treasuries on the secondary market. What that means is that you're actually not adding new liquidity into the system. So basically you're buying treasury on the secondary market. And it's no different from reverse repo, SLF, MLF, the PBOC is already doing. So it's important to differentiate a normal sort of a money market operation from QE, where QE is a increase of existing liquidity. So it's pumping in new liquidity, say, for example, by PBOC buying a new treasury bond with new printed money. So that would be classified as a QE. There was another sort of a press headline saying that the PBOC is offering 500 billion yuan worth of rediscount loan to the tech sector. I think that was from last night. Now, that is not a QE either, you know, because I think a bit more than a year ago, the PBOC launched the special rediscount loan program for the tech sector. So I think it's to the amount of well over 400 billion yuan back then. So by now, some of the loans must have matured. And so the PBOE is reissuing the rediscount loan of, you know, 500 billion just to cover that. So it's a renewal of the existing credit facility rather than adding in new liquidity. To me, that's not QE either. When we see physical monetization, when we see, for example, printing money to buy asset in the market, then it will be QE. Unless we see that right now, it's just a normal course of operation for the PBOC.
That's a very interesting point, because you mentioned that what the PBOC is going to do is not even part of the QE. It doesn't fulfill the definition of QE. So the market is not just overreacting to the news. It's probably overinterpreting what the PBOC is going to do. I think it's also worth mentioning that the fundamental is recovering. As we see from the PMI numbers, there seems to be some green shoots in the Chinese economy. The Qingming Festival data has also been strong. So I guess a question as a follow-up to you, how is that with some improvements in the fundamental, would that support a further recovery in the stock market? And if you agree, what kind of sectors should we position ourselves in?
I think, not surprisingly, we're seeing very strong domestic consumption data over the Qingming Festival. So that's the season when the Chinese people go back hometown to pay tribute to their ancestors and also get back together with families. It's actually one of the most important festivals in the Chinese calendar. So not surprisingly, we're seeing quite a bit of movements in the domestic travel sectors. So hotels are fully booked. Air tickets are very difficult to come by. And also high-speed train tickets are very difficult to buy as well. So I think for people who have been traveling in the mainland provinces would have experienced similar experience back then. So what that means is that one shouldn't be too surprised to see a strong set of data coming from the Qingming period. And if so, it's more a confirmation of the existing knowledge that we've known rather than new information. So I wouldn't be surprised to see the Chinese domestic consumption data continue to surprise on the upside in the remaining months of the year. I think reason being, right now, the Chinese attitude towards buying a house seems to be changing, which is good news and bad. You know, the bad news is that, you know, it's bad for the apartment sales, for the developers. Actually, this morning, Shima, one of the major developers listed in Hong Kong, reported that the CCB is asking it to wind down its operations. It's sort of challenging for the developers. But then on the other hand, the good news is that the Chinese economy seems to be restructuring successfully. For years, we've been talking about building a domestic consumption-driven economy, but for years, because of the focus is on growth, and for years, to achieve that growth, really the easiest way is through leveraging on ever-rising property price. So to that end, we haven't been successful building a consumption-driven economy until now. So right now, you're seeing a clear dichotomy in the Chinese economy. So on one hand, the developers continue to ail and fail, but then on the other hand, domestic consumption seems to be picking up in a way that we would have never expected. So one shouldn't be too surprised to see domestic consumption data continue to surprise on the upside, while the property sector is probably continue to fail. But it's actually a sign of economic restructuring. But I would also caution against, you know, reading too much into the sort of short-term strong data, consumption data, because this is more a concurrent confirmation of what we already know rather than new information. I think going forward, what is going to determine where the asset price is going to go is the Sino-US relationship, the exchange rate fixing by the central bank and the central bank's attitude towards the currency movement, and also the market sentiment coming from the improved relationship between US and China, also coming from a more clear understanding of what the central bank is going to do with its monetary and exchange rate policy.
Gotcha. So those are the key factors marginally driving the market, hopefully upwards, in the next couple of months. Among the many sectors in China, currently, I'm most focused on two areas. First one is electric vehicle. I've been talking about positive things about EV theme for 2 years already. This theme has been extremely popular, companies delivering strong results over the past 2 years. But how you may also have probably noticed in this reporting season, a couple of EV companies have started to disappoint, either in the guidance or the actual results. And at the same time, we've seen more intense competition among brands in China, and that gets people worried whether the industry is getting into so-called high volume, low margin trend. The second one is what you just mentioned, China-US relations. I do look forward to hearing more of your insights on that, because the CXO sector has been totally hammered with that latest bill from the US Congress targeting at them. And investors are getting a little bit concerned on these Chinese companies with US exposure, particularly in 2024, which is a US election year. Having said all these, as you previously mentioned, we now see President Xi Jinping meeting the US business leaders just a couple of days ago. The US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen just concluded her visit in China. So it does feel that the China-US relations have slightly improved. So with all these headlines and, I would say, confusion, what should we consider when we invest in these sectors, particularly those are exposed to US-China relations? A lot of back and forth going on, but what really drives the relation, and are there any other sectors that you would recommend investors to focus on if the market does continue to go up because of improving fundamentals?
Yeah, I think one of the remaining unanswered question is the direction of where the US and Chinese relationship is heading. So we had a really rough year over the past 3 years, and it's been moving the market in a very negative way. So Hong Kong has been down like 4 years in a row now. So it's still struggling to break above a key technical level. And then at the same time, we do see favorable development between the two sides. For example, Yellen just completed her visit to China second time in a row in less than a year. And I think that is telling us that the communication channel between the two sides are being re-established. And also, you know, the military generals are talking once again on both sides as well. So I think those are very encouraging signs for risk assets, having seen how important it has been in the past 3 years. I think going forward, because as you mentioned, this is election year, and obviously the Sino-US relation would be one of the key debating topic between the two candidates. Now, the thing is that because being hawkish towards China has been a consensus bilateral view between two parties, I'm wondering if you continue to hammer on this relationship, this factor, whether it will do more good for the debate between the candidates. And also, as we know, because the two countries mutually benefited from this very significant relationship in the geopolitics, in the global arena, ever since China joined the WTO in 2001. So the US consumer were able to live on much cheaper Chinese exports, while, you know, China was able to build on its US dollar reserve and use the capital inflow to build the Chinese economy. So both sides are benefiting from this relationship. What that means is that if you continue to hammer on China, continue to be very hardcore on how the Chinese should behave, then inevitably there would be like pushback from the Chinese side and also harmful to the US economy. For example, many of the rare metal that is being used to produce semiconductor chips, China is the biggest producer. So it has been the biggest producer for years now, and it's a key ingredient to make high-tech semiconductor chips at this stage. Also, China has been very strong in developing CXO drugs, because the development cost has been so much lower than it is in the US. And also, nowadays, China absolutely dominating the EV sectors and also the solar panel sectors. These are the comparative advantage that China was able to enjoy, not purely from government subsidy. It's actually from how much lower the Chinese production cost is, and also because EVs technical entry barrier is very, very low. Indeed, the key piece of technology in EV is actually the battery. So in the field of rechargeable battery, China has been a global leader for decades now. So because of that, the Chinese EV industry was able to leverage upon the key battery technology and also was able to build learning from Tesla's super factory established in Shanghai. So in so doing, the so-called unfair advantage that the Chinese EV industry was able to enjoy wasn't because, well, at least wasn't entirely because of Chinese government subsidy is because of the key piece of technology that the Chinese battery industry was already possessed, and also the lessons or the experience that we gained from building the Tesla superfactory in Shanghai. So it would be unfair to assume that China is trying to dump its excess capacity onto the foreign market, you know, because as you know, clearly China is the lowest cost producer in this industry, and the other foreign countries have been able to enjoy much lower priced of Chinese EVs, right? So it's mutually beneficiary as well. I think the Chinese EV manufacturers now is the largest exporter of the world, but then they have been quite sort of self-conscious regarding pricing for the foreign markets. For example, BYD's car sell price in Europe is double the price domestically. What that means is that in order to avoid the suspicion of dumping, the Chinese EV manufacturers were pricing their products higher overseas to avoid this suspicion, also to avoid sanctions from governments. So those are very interesting developments. I think seeing it from a different angle, from a more economically sensible angle, and also not to continue to hammer China on this kind of issues, would actually help the candidates, the presidential contestants this year in the debate. And also the U.S. need to be reminded that it shouldn't be sort of overplaying its hands, you know, because the more you sort of hammer on your component, probably the harder the pushback you're going to get from this country. So I think going forward, obviously a marginal improving relationship between U.S. and China is probably one of the factors that hasn't been priced in and is favorable for the market if the relationship play out as we discussed just now.
Well, that's an interesting angle that you discussed about the U.S.-China relations, and to some extent, fairly contrarian. So I'm sure that interests our audience. Anyway, Hao, let's move on to talk about gold before we end. Actually, I came across a data point on Bloomberg this morning, which says it's already the 17th month in which China's central bank increases its gold reserve. Now, meanwhile, we are also seeing that the gold prices are surging. Now, at this point of time, we at Julius Baer are still maintaining a relatively cautious view on gold. But of course, we are aware that quite a lot of investors are actually bullish on gold. So anyway, here are the two questions I want to ask you, Hao. First, why do you think the central banks in China and around the world are increasing the gold reserve persistently over the past 2 years? And second, I'm aware that you may have a different view on gold than us, so could you share your thoughts so that our audience gets both the bullish and the bearish sides of the gold story?
Yeah, I think gold is probably not on many people's radar until recently. So yesterday, gold price has risen 15%, and it's very, very strong. And also in recent weeks, it's gone vertical. It's unprecedented in the sense that gold price is soaring against a relatively strong US dollar and also rising US bond yield. So it's very uncommon for gold price to rise against such backdrop, and it's happening. So it's catching everybody's attention. Also, if you look at the gold ETF positions in gold, the positions in gold in this ETFs is actually declining, not rising. But then at the same time, gold price is diverging from the falling ETF holdings. So it's quite phenomenal as well. So apparently the central banks has been buying, especially the PBOC. The PBOC has been buying 17 months in a row. Obviously it's been accumulating gold on its balance sheet, and I think it has accumulated 3,500 tons already. So I wouldn't be surprised to see PBOC continue to buy gold. So I think at this juncture, many people think that gold is a sort of a inflationary hedge and it's a risk aversion play. Both arguments I disagree. Now, firstly, inflation is still above central bank's target level, but is substantially lower than last year. So if you're arguing that gold is hedging against inflation at this juncture rather than last year, is inexplicable. And I think secondly, if you look at the geopolitical risk, it's actually rising, not falling. So risk aversion or gold's risk hedging capability is really against some sort of a black swan event, some uncertainties that is hard to hedge against. So gold is not a risk aversion play as the consensus believe. Rather, it's an uncertainty aversion play. There's a big difference between uncertainties and risk. Right? Risk, you can quantify it, but uncertainties, you can only do scenario analysis. And I think gold is an uncertainty aversion play, and it is doing it quite well now. So I think just now we discussed about the US-China relationship, election cycle, and also in the other parts of the world, the geopolitical uncertainty seems to be heightened. You know, for example, the Middle East situation and also the Russian-Ukraine war seems to be ongoing with no end in sight. I think all these are adding to gold's sort of the role as an uncertainty hedger and also one of the most misunderstood asset class in the global market. So I think as a result, the gold price is rising well above expectation. I think since October last year, we've been very bullish on gold. Not only the technical chart looks really strong and the factors that I discussed just now, you know, gradually come into play. So more and more people realize at this juncture, gold can be a good asset allocation in a portfolio. Even if you're not trading, so you're just adding gold to your position as a way to sort of show uncorrelated price movements against the other asset classes, it's actually worthwhile to have it in your portfolio. So I think we're still bullish on gold. I think this trend will surge well beyond most people's expectations. So I think obviously in the short run, technically gold is so overbought. It's just phenomenal. So if there's short-term pullback, then I think we should look at opportunities to build a position in gold if people missed the first part of the rally.
Interesting. Thank you for sharing the bullish side of the gold arguments. Anyway, that's pretty much all we have to discuss today. Thank you again, Hao, for your sharing. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening and stay tuned for our next podcast. Goodbye and speak soon.
Thanks, Richard.
You have been listening to Beyond Markets by Julius Baer. If you like what you've heard, please tell us by leaving a review and rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Subscribe to Beyond Markets on your favorite podcast player to stay up to date with our latest episodes. To learn more about Julius Baer, our people, our latest thinking, visit us at www.juliusbaer.com. We will be back with a brand new episode soon. The information and opinions expressed in this podcast constitute marketing material and are not the result of independent financial or investment research. Please refer to www.juliusbaer.com/legal/podcast for further important legal information.